So the idea is we're not doing high-energy physics here, but we still might be able to do fundamental physics by using techniques that have an incredible amount of precision. So with enough precision, the idea is you could potentially see new physics that's out there, and it might be sort of a complementary way to do it that is it's somehow different than the usual collider approach. So I'm going to tell you about Tesla gravity and quantum mechanics using atom interferometry. And so just to start off, this picture that you're looking at here, this is data from one of our atom interferometers. You can see this sort of blue background, and there should be, it's kind of a little bit unsaturated, but you can see two spikes here. A spike in the foreground, a spike in the back here. And what those are that's showing you a snapshot that we took of our in the middle of an atom interferometer, and those two spikes represent the probability distribution of an atom. That's not making it better. So in particular, this is, you can think of it as an ensemble of atoms in a superposition of two locations. So the atoms here and here, and they're separated in this case by 54 centimeters. So this is something we did last summer. And so this is just to give you an idea of the kinds of things we can now do with atoms. And so I'm going to explain to you how we did that and what it means for tests of quantum mechanics and how we can use this kind of what turns out to be a very precise tool, very precise accelerometer, in fact, to study things like gravity. Okay, so enough introduction. Okay, so first, a brief review or intro to atom interferometry by way of analogy. So at the top here, I've got a light interferometer, which you're, I'm sure, familiar with. So the idea is you send in light to a beam splitter, and the light can then be divided along an upper path and a lower path. You use a couple of mirrors to bring the beams of light back around so that they cross. And then if you want to see interference, you apply a second beam splitter, shown here. And then with a couple of detectors, you can then measure the light intensity in two different ports, port one and port two. And as the phase difference between the two paths is varied, the optical path length is changed, you'll see the light intensity swing between one port and the other. And in fact, if you even look with a camera on one of the ports, you might see something that looks like this red picture here with these circular fringes. And that would be sort of a spatial version of the interference pattern. So that's all standard. So what I'm going to be telling you about today is how to do the same kind of geometry, this sort of Mach-Zehnder interferometer, but using matter waves instead of light waves to do the interference. So here's the analogy. We start off with, rather than a beam of light, we start off with an atom. Think of this just as an individual atom. And we're going to send it through this Mach-Zehnder geometry. We have an upper arm and a lower arm. We're going to use, it turns out, pulses of light, shown here as gray squiggly lines. Those pulses of light will implement what we call atom optics. They serve as the beam splitters and mirrors for atom de Broglie waves. And so by pulsing that light on and off, we can bring the atom around two different paths and produce an interference pattern over here. And so just like in the case of light, we have two ports, this red dashed port and a blue solid port. And by looking at the number of atoms that show up in those two locations, that's the equivalent of the intensity at the two detectors, we can measure that interference pattern. And sort of to complete the analogy, the analogy of the circular fringes, this is a picture coming out of our interferometer. This is data once again. And these stripes, this represents a spatial interference pattern. The regions of blue and red are correlated and anti-correlated. And so that's a sort of a de Broglie wave interference pattern on a camera. And so it's sort of very much in the same spirit. Okay, so before I get into the details of, and I won't dwell too long on the details, but I wanted to give you a little bit of a sense of how we actually implement those atom optics. But before, I'll just want to put this in the context of the technology that we use. So this is cold atom, so we're using laser cooling. We're using the tools that are used to make Bose-Einstein condensates. In fact, much of the work I'll describe here was done using BECs. So we cool atoms down to their very, very cold center mass degrees freedoms. They're very well controlled. And you can see sort of a progression of the technology starting it first demonstrated in the early 90s, the first atom interferometer. And since then, at that time, of course, they're sort of laboratory scale. And since then, there's been work in miniaturizing these systems because it turns out they can be used for their commercial applications to making a really good accelerometer, a really good gyroscope. And so where what starts off to be the size of a room, now you can make it, this is in 2008, I guess this middle picture, sort of less than a meter in scale. And more recently, there are now commercially available gravimeters that work on this this same principle that I'll be telling you about. And that's not super relevant for what I'm telling you about today, other than it does give us a handle. It lets us hopefully deploy some of this technology eventually into space missions where we can hopefully look for things like gravitational waves. And that's what I'll spend some time on the second half of the talk trying to describe for you. Okay, so coming back to atom interferometry. So here's a sort of pictorial view of how we implement our beam splitters and mirrors. There are two basic principles involved. So we've got light absorption and stimulated emission. So that light absorption, we have an atom that starts off in its ground state. So I've got this little circular picture. The circle here represents an atom, and there's two levels. We'll say it's a two-level atom. If the atom starts off in the blue ground state, if it absorbs a photon of light, it can be raised into the red excited state. In the process of absorbing that photon, though, we have to conserve momentum. And so if the atom absorbed it, that means that afterwards it's traveling at some velocity we call the recoil velocity, which is h bar k of the photon divided by the mass of the atom m. So that's how we can give a momentum kick, or we can give a velocity kick, I should say, to an atom by having it absorb light. Now, the reverse process we also use, stimulated emission. If an atom starts off in the excited red state, if a photon comes in, there's an enhanced probability that that atom will emit a photon into the direction of that the photon that's already there and putting it back into the ground state. And in the process, if the atom is moving with some velocity, it will now be at rest. So what's shown here on the right is Rabi oscillations between the ground and excited state in the presence of an exciting laser beam. And this is how we actually control the momentum transfer to the atom. So this is versus time that the light is on, the light that's inducing these transitions. So if you start off in the red state, if you start off in the blue state with 100% probability, maybe in some momentum p, as a function of time, you'll swing the state will swing between states 1 and states 2, and they're sort of entangled with the momentum transfer from the light. And so in that way, we can choose a beam splitter or a mirror. So in particular, if you look at keep the light on for pulse area pi over 2, then the atom is in a 50-50 superposition of states 1 and state 2. And that means half the atom has absorbed a photon and will be recoiling. And that's a beam splitter for us. Half the atom will then sort of start to move away from the other half. Whereas if you leave the light on for twice as long, that's called a pi pulse. And that sort of acts as a mirror. We can take an atom that's fast and slow it down, and vice versa. So let's go through that once. So here's the same space-time diagram of the atom interferometer that I showed you on the first slide. Time going to the right, the height of the atom or the position of the atom vertically. And so we're going to start off in the blue state, which I'm calling momentum p. And so we apply our beam splitter by leaving the light on for pi over 2 duration. And after that, then we have a superposition of p and p plus k. Now, I'm going to stuff in a little phase factor here, e to the I delta phi, just to keep track of the fact that ultimately the interferometer will be what we're trying to read out of it, this phase delta phi, is going to encode the sorts of physics that we're looking for, looking to measure with this device. So in general, you'll have some phase shift between those two halves of the atom. So after you split it, the two halves spatially separate. You can see the red dashed line gets further away from the blue line. So at some point, we apply a mirror pulse to reverse the relative velocity. The fast state becomes slow. The slow state becomes fast. Then we wait an equal amount of time so that the two halves of the atom reconverge and apply a second beam splitter pulse, which then results in this final state, which displays interference. So in particular, if you then look at the probability of finding an atom in state p or p plus k, which corresponds to the two ports up here, red and blue, the probability varies like sine squared of that phase delta phi that I put in. And so the data analysis is really easy. We just take a picture of the atom distribution at the end. And this is showing what that distribution looks like. You see two mounds of atoms, two clumps of atoms. And as the phase shift delta phi is varied, the population oscillates back and forth between those two locations on the camera. So you just count how many atoms, and that tells you what the phase shift is. So you can think about this. I've talked about it like one atom at a time. In practice, we use an ensemble of many atoms so that we get statistics faster. And that's what this picture is showing. OK, great. So that's the sort of the details of how the interferometer works. Here's maybe a bit more realistic version. We have a vacuum chamber. These are all one-dimensional experiments I'll be telling you about. So the atoms are in free fall vertically. Gravity is down here. And so while the atoms are, we launch them upward actually, and so they have a little bit longer to fall. While the atoms fall, go up and down, we apply laser pulses shown as red arrows here along that vertical direction, and those implement the beam splitters and the mirrors. And so you can see the same diagram again here now, just with the curved trajectories as the atom falls. And so the some of the motivation of our work is directed towards how to make these sensors as precise as possible. And I won't go into too much detail of sort of how you calculate the response of this, but just to say, it turns out that this is an accelerometer that's sensitive to the acceleration of gravity in this case, and it turns out the sensitivity can be enhanced by increasing the area of the interferometer. You want to make in this case the space-time area as large as possible. And so what that means is you want the time, t, to be, or this duration of the interferometer to be as long as you can. And if you can, you'd like the separation vertically between the two halves of the atom to be as big as possible. And so that sort of has motivated the direction that we've taken the apparatus. It's not too surprising that the response to gravity is better if you wait longer. It's simply easier to see how much something's accelerating if you let it fall for a longer amount of time. And that's where this is coming from. Okay, so that motivates our why we're making the apparatus in the way that we do, and I'll show you that on the next slide. But before I do, I just wanted to tell you all the things I'm not going to tell you about in this talk. I think there's lots of interesting tests of fundamental physics that we could use this technology for. I'll touch on a few of these, but in particular, I'll tell you about ongoing tests of the equivalence principle. If you have a really good accelerometer, you can compare two kinds of atoms and look for deviations. We think we can potentially do really well there. It's also that same sort of apparatus can be used to look for just generically new light fields that could potentially be dark matter candidates. And so I'll say a word about that. We've thought about post-Newtonian effects, so corrections to Newtonian gravity that we could see in this interferometer. I won't have time to talk about those. And then I'll spend some time discussing gravitational wave gravitational wave detection, as I mentioned. Okay, so let me then get to it. So this is what the apparatus looks like. This is what we built in the basement of the Stanford Physics Building. So since we want the time to be as long as we can get, we built a vertical tower in a pit. This is a 10-meter long vacuum chamber, so that we have multiple seconds for the atoms to fall. That's one of the ways to get high sensitivity. So you're looking at sort of a 10-meter tall tower here. At the bottom of the tower, there's a source of ultra-cold atoms. This is a BEC machine for rubidium. So we make the cold cloud down here, doing laser cooling and then evaporative cooling. And then we launch the atoms from the bottom, and they enter a magnetically shielded region where they fall for, like I said, around 2 seconds in the shield, it turns out. So you can see a little bit what the machine looks like at the bottom. And we need really cold atoms to do this for a number of reasons. One is simply if the atoms aren't cold enough, they'll just expand while they're falling and they'll hit the wall. So this is a picture of an ensemble that's a little bit less than 3 nanokelvin in temperature. A lot of the data I'll show you is even colder than that. So the colder the better for a lot of this work. All right, so that was all by way of introduction. This is the first results that I'll show you. This was taken data in 2012 and 2013, the first time we got the interferometer to work. So we have our space-time diagram. And if you want, you can actually sort of interrupt this process just to characterize what's going on. And that's what this picture on the right is. So if we take a picture of the atom distribution at time capital T, that's the time when the atom is in the maximum wave packet separation that it's going to have for the entire interferometer. What you'll do is you'll collapse the wave function. The atom will be, you'll find that each atom either one location or the other, but you've got an ensemble. And so what you end up seeing is a picture that looks like this. So these two bumps are the two different locations that the atom was in a superposition of being in those two different places. And as you can see in this case, since we have such a long free fall time, that separation is about 1.5 centimeters wave packet separation. Or so I say. This, of course, is not in a superposition. Once I've taken the picture, I've collapsed the wave function. I don't know if it would have interfered. So in order to check that, we have to make sure not to take such a picture, usually. And so instead, we let the atoms come back together. and complete the sequence, and then we take a picture at the end where we have two ports, port one and port two, which will, so as we expect the population between those two to vary as the phases change. And you can see that behavior in the lower part of this slide. So the phase is shown along the bottom is for different phases in the interferometer. You see on the far left, most of the atoms are in the upper location of the picture, and then it sort of oscillates down to the lower part of the picture as the phase has changed. Yes, please.
What are the photons that you're hitting the atoms with? What are the frequencies?
Yeah, so this is all at 780 nanometers, so it's sort of just out of the visible range. Yeah, and so and in fact, I should say these pictures are fluorescence images. So we to take these pictures, we shine light, and the atoms resonantly fluoresce, and we collect that light to see where they are. And so the sensitivity of this at the sort of over 2 second duration turned out to be about 7 × 10^-12 g per shot. That's how good we can resolve small acceleration. So it's quite sensitive. And if you average for, in this case, we did about an hour, we got well into the 10^-13 g range. And that is starting to get interesting for tests of the equivalence principle. I think we can do a lot better than that if we average for longer. And with some of the other enhancement techniques that I'll tell you about in a moment, we can do a lot better than that. Just one more point. This is a sort of a technical point. If you look at the output of this interferometer, so this is the population ratio that I plotted here versus trial. So we every time you do one of these interferometers, you measure one phase shift. You see actually a quite messy looking distribution. You don't see this nice, beautiful phase evolution that this picture suggests. And that's because, in fact, for a given shot, the phase is totally random for us. And that is not fundamental. That's a technical source of noise coming from the fact that the ground is shaking in our lab at a level much higher than the sensitivity of the machine. So, you know, I said 10^-12 here. The ground shakes at sort of 10^-8, 10^-9 at the best if you do it in a really quiet location, G, I should say. So there's orders of magnitude more vibration, and that totally scrambles, gives you way more than 2 pi of phase, and so you see totally a noisy signal. So you should be thinking, how can you possibly do anything with this? And I'll explain to you how. I just want to emphasize that this noise here is, it's not fundamental. We are actually just measuring the vibration of the ground very precisely. An uninteresting quantity, we're measuring it very precisely with many digits on a vibrating ground. And just the punchline at how we use this, any experiment that we will do to test fundamental physics or anything else with an apparatus with a sensitivity will always be differential. Differential measurement. We'll take two different ensembles that are both experiencing the same vibration noise or the same laser noise, as it turns out as well, can cause this, and subtract those two phases and look for a difference. So if for example, in an equivalence principle measurement, you take two different kinds of atoms, two different isotopes. They share the same vibrational environment, and so that noise can cancel to an incredibly high degree. OK, so coming back to the picture I showed you on the intro slide. So this is the wave packet separation in our most extreme that we've been able to do so far. So you can see it's actually kind of hard to see, possibly, because they're really small. But there's a rainbow-colored spike on each end of this slide. And that's the same thing as this picture here. It's just now the separation has been increased by a large degree. So this is about half a meter. And so I wanted to tell you how we did that. Okay, so the basic idea is the modification of the sequence I already showed you. And to split the atoms by a large amount, you want to make them split at a faster rate. So you want to transfer more momentum. So rather than just do a single pi over 2 beam splitter pulse, we augment that. We add additional laser pulses. And so you can see that this is the position of the atom versus time. So these black dots correspond to applied laser pulses. You can kind of see a pulse train down here in blue. So after the first pi over 2, we hit it with multiple additional pi pulses, which serve to transfer additional momentum. So every one of these adds 2 h bar k more momentum to the atom. And you can see it's sort of accelerating away. So after we do that, the atom's going a lot faster. So we have to decelerate it with sort of a symmetric series of pulses to bring it back down to the initial velocity. And that gives us a bigger separation between the two halves of the atom. And then to close the interferometer, we just do the same thing on the other side. And that sort of scales up. The more pulses you apply, the better sensitivity you expect to have. And just if you zoom in on any one of these dots, any one of these black dots, what you would see is the physics is going on here. Is actually a two-photon Bragg scattering event. The red colored interference pattern here represents a laser standing wave that's actually driving these two photon transitions. And so an atom coming in at plus at 2h bar k will diffract off that standing wave and leave at 4h bar k, whereas an atom at 0h bar k will be unaffected because it's Doppler detuned. So we can just selectively apply Bragg transitions multiple times to add more momentum. So initial results, when we did this technique, we could do about 4 centimeters, which corresponds to 6h bar k of momentum transfer. By adding more pulses, we were able to do 30 and eventually 90 h bar k of separation between the two halves of the atom. Even though this is, I think, somewhat challenging, it's not nearly as impressive as actually seeing interference. So far, this is just splitting an atom. It's just like the other picture. It's collapsed. You don't know that there's any coherence. So in order to actually observe that, you need to bring it back together. And I haven't shown you that yet. So stay tuned. OK, so but first, before I do, I wanted to give a little bit of a zoom in here. So if we come in down almost at the noise floor here, you can see some interesting stuff. Or maybe not. It's maybe hard to see. So the atoms on the far left correspond to the atoms that are at 0h bar k. And the spike way on the right is the one atoms at 90h bar k. But since this is a series of pulses, you might expect to see a little bit of residual atoms at each of the intermediate locations. So this is where you would expect to see atoms at 2 and 4h bar k. And so you expect to see sort of a train of atoms that might have got left behind if you didn't do a great job. What you probably can't tell is there is a very small bump here at 2h bar k, but then after that, it falls into the noise very rapidly. So this is just to say the pulses are rather efficient. And by the time you get out to 90h bar k, there's really nothing anymore. And so it's quite clean. OK, so here's the evidence for interference. Once again, in the same apparatus. So this is just two shots selected as a control, a 2h bar k interferometer. So these are labeled by the phase shift. This is delta phi of 0, delta phi of pi. So when you change the phase by pi, the atoms move from this spot to this spot. That's the same phase shift I was telling you about before. It controls where on the picture the atom cloud shows up. So it oscillates back and forth between those two. Now, this is the same then idea, but now for the 90h bar k wave packet separation. And what you should see is that as the phase is changed, the population is modulating between those two locations. Not perfectly. But there's still order one change in the amplitude of these two spikes. And that is evidence of constructive and destructive interference of the matter waves. So we can be a bit more quantitative about that. And the way we analyze how well the interference is happening is by scanning what we call the contrast envelope. And what this essentially amounts to doing is slightly detuning the interferometer and looking for the contrast loss as that detuning is applied. And so effectively, we delay slightly the application of the last pulse. And what that does, and you can see an animation here on the right, as this is the time delay that we apply, delaying when the last pulse happens, so it makes the interferometer slightly asymmetric. And what you see is you get fringes. And the reason for that is that these atoms, there's a velocity shear across the atom wave packet. So you get a position-dependent phase that shows up if the atoms aren't perfectly overlapped. And so the blue, the yellow and the green represent sort of the two halves of the atom coming back together. Those are the two sort of input states to the final beam splitter. And then the blue shows what their superposition looks like, or what the interference is doing. And so when you're right aligned, you get a nice spike. But very rapidly, if you detune it, you should get a lot of fringes. And we see that experimentally. You can see as you detune the time of the last pulse, you get vertical stripes, which are exactly correspond to these interference fringes due to this velocity shear. And so the point is that if you don't resolve these fringes like we do in this picture, it looks like a contrast loss. If you integrate over those fringes, it just goes away. And so you get an exponential loss of the population modulation in the presence of such interference fringes if you just average over them. And so that's what we see. As the time is varied on the x-axis here, the amount of modulation is falling off very rapidly. And what this is essentially doing is measuring the coherence length of our source. And as we expect, the higher momentum transfer falls off faster simply because the atoms are coming in at a higher velocity. So they move outside the coherence length at a faster rate. And that all sort of lines up. So it behaves as you'd expect from quantum mechanics.
Yes. How many atoms do you have in this?
This is about 10 to the 5 atoms per shot. Yeah.
Okay. And how many do you get in the end? Is it orbit one just, or Most of them already.
Yes. Okay. So this is sort of the punchline. Then taking that analysis that I just showed you, the contrast envelopes, the peak of the contrast envelope when everything is really well aligned, that's how many atoms are participating in the interference. And so what you can see this, and we call that the contrast, the fraction of the atoms that are swinging back and forth between the two halves, the two ports. And so for 2H bar K, the contrast is 1, or actually it's like 98% we get. Our uncertainty is on the order of 1% on that, so it's quite good. And then as you increase the number of photons, we see sort of an order one loss of contrast, but basically so something around 30% for 90 H bar K. And one of the limitations actually for us, the reason we didn't go to like 200 H bar K, was that we were running out of atoms. So this is an inset showing here that in addition to the contrast, the other thing you want to know, you're asking about, is how many atoms are still around. And we lose about a factor of 10 or more, actually. It looks like a little bit more than the factor of 10. And that's actually completely expected. That's due to spontaneous emission. Instead of Bragg scattering, the atoms are undergoing spontaneous emission events, scattering into 4pi. And that's something we can control simply by the correct laser engineering. With this generation of the lasers, we expect it to happen right where it did. And with the next generation of lasers, we can suppress that by quite a bit. Yeah, we think we can do quite a bit more wave packet separation. Just to give you an idea, we routinely do 1,000 H bar K momentum transfer when we launch the atoms in the lattice. So that's an example of sort of where we can go. Yeah, I think we can do 10^6 potentially. So, yeah, so that's something we're working on right now. Okay, so I didn't want to spend too much more time on this, but I just wanted to show you the evidence we have for robust interference, even at sort of macroscopic, sort of meter scale. And once again, these are second long. So we're at times of seconds, durations of half a meter, and we still see quantum mechanics behaving the way we expect. And so just to put that in context, this is a quick table. I won't go through all this, but just comparing what I've just shown you to other matter wave interferometers. So we're here at the top here with half a meter and a little over a second. There's a variety of different experiments here. Some atom interferometers. There's a neutron interferometer experiment on here. You can see neutrons actually do 7 centimeters wave packet separation, fairly good. But the duration for the neutron interferometer is only on the order of tens of microseconds. So it's rather short compared to what we're doing. The neutrons are going quickly through the experiment. There's also some experiments on here. This line here, line number 3, is with a very large organic molecule from the ARNT group in Vienna, where the mass of this atom is something like 5,000 AMU. So this is a very large thing that they're able to observe interference with. And so the question I'm trying to get at here is, it seems like intuitively that we're testing something about quantum mechanics in a macroscopic regime. It's big separations, long time. Is that interesting in any way? Have we tested something about quantum mechanics? And you can ask the question about whether it's more interesting to make a more massive object or a bigger separation. But if you want to see how we stack up, we basically have the biggest separations in the longest times, but not the biggest masses. To try to be a little bit more quantitative about this, it's actually really hard. What do you mean by testing quantum mechanics? What we can say is that as far as we can tell from our experiment, the quantum superposition principle behaves as you would expect at the half meter scale. Okay, maybe you wouldn't be surprised by that. But there are theories that suggest that it might not work. And so these are basically motivated by the idea that we don't observe basketballs and quantum superpositions or something, right? So where is it that quantum mechanics somehow turns into the classical world? So sort of a question that some people want to think about. And maybe there's some modification of quantum mechanics that comes in such that macroscopic systems don't behave the way the quantum world suggests that they would. And so we could maybe put some constraints on those types of theories. And so this is in the context of those, there's a model that we're putting some bounds on. Maybe you've heard of these. They go by various names. Continuous spontaneous localization is one type model. The DOC-Penrose model, perhaps, where gravitationally induced collapse of the wave function. So there's a number of models out there that you've maybe heard of. This is a formalism that tries to characterize the macroscopicity. How macroscopic is an object? And in that context, we've constrained, we can put some constraints in that parameter space. So the vertical axis here is essentially a measure of how long the superposition existed. So for our case, like a second, versus how big you were able to separate it. And it's all scaled in such a way that you can compare experiments of different kinds. And so you can see in green here are our bounds, and we do set good bounds with respect to other experiments in sort of the sort of meter range. And whether or not you find that super interesting depends on how seriously you take these theories. But I think it's something that's worth thinking about a little bit. But at the very least, we can definitely say that we're testing an axiom of quantum mechanics, and it seems to behave as we expect. OK, so let me move on to testing the equivalence principle. It's another thing we've been working on. Oh, sure, yeah. That's one of the things that I find frustrating. I don't think so. Yeah, not that I know of. So in other words, you're just putting bounds on parameters. So I think it's a way of comparing to other experiments and seeing how macroscopic they are. But I don't know of a good, where would you put a theory blob on here?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think, so in particular, the Penrose collapse model is probably more massive objects do a lot better than we do. I wouldn't suggest that we're putting any interesting bounds on the DOC Penrose model. On the continuous spontaneous localization, I think we do put some bounds, and I think this space does reflect that kind of theory. But I'm happy to talk more about this if anyone is interested. I'm in fact generally interested in any ways of thinking about tests of quantum mechanics, if people find that an interesting topic. Okay, so let me sort of shift gears a little bit and tell you about our ongoing work to test the equivalence principle. This is motivated by the fact that it is one of the axioms of GR. And if there's a new theory of gravity, a quantum theory of gravity maybe, generically you expect there to be some kind of violation of the equivalence principle. It's very hard to have a theory that doesn't do that. So that's sort of the motivation here. So you can see the history of EP tests on this scatter plot in terms of the so-called eta parameter, which is the differential acceleration delta A divided by the mean acceleration of the test bodies. And so the current records are set by two experiments. There's a retroreflection array on the moon that allows us to do radar ranging or laser ranging of the Earth-Moon distance. And that's done to about part in 10 to the 13, delta G over G. A little bit better than that, there are a series of excellent experiments out of the University of Washington with torsion balances, and those currently set the limit on how precisely we know that different kinds of material fall towards the center of the Earth. And so what we'd like to do is ask, can we move the current range, which is around 10 to the minus 13, can we bring it down a couple of orders of magnitude, perhaps, with atom interferometry? And in particular, I've been showing you data with rubidium 87 so far. We'd like to add in some rubidium 85, another isotope, and compare their accelerations. And so just to give you an idea of the order of magnitude of that, so this is our tower. So the phase shift, or the gravity sensitivity scales as follows. So delta G over G goes like our phase resolution delta phi divided by the gravity phase response, which is kgt squared. K or k effective is the is proportional to the momentum transfer that we give our atoms. So it's the laser wave vector, and t is the duration of our interferometer. And so plugging in sort of conservative parameters, 2h bar k, which was the first data I showed you, and about 2 seconds. You get a phase shift of 3/10 to the 8 radians. That's why our machine is so sensitive to accelerations. The phase response is very high. We have a lot of radians of shift for 1 g of acceleration. And if you then assume atom Schottenhoyer's limited detection for the phase resolution and integrate down for about a month, you can approach sensitivities of 10 to the minus 15 g. Now, I hope that these numbers aren't the limit. I don't think they are. Because as I already showed you, we found ways of increasing K effective by adding more momentum to the atom. And I showed you 90 H bar K. So that is an immediate sort of linear gain in sensitivity, just for an example. So to compare the phase response for the interferometer at 90 H bar K that I already showed you was something like 10 to the 10 radians per G, just under that. So that's directly helping this argument. So if you can do that well, this is one way to talk about the theory reach of such an experiment. So you can talk about it in terms of new forces that would violate the equivalence principle, forces we don't know about. And so if you assume a Yukawa-type interaction, modification of gravity, with a strength alpha and a range lambda. You can plot in sort of alpha lambda space how well different experiments bound charge differences of these new forces. And so the dashed line shows the existing bound from the Adelberger work at the University of Washington. And these blue, red, and purple lines are bounds that we could set with our rubidium-85, rubidium-87 experiment, assuming different couplings. So it depends on the model that you choose. So in purple here would be a new force that couples to baryon minus lepton number. And you can see as a function of wavelength, it varies based on sort of how far away the test masses are from the gravitating body. Which is the Earth. So another thing you can do, and I mentioned this at the beginning, is you can use the same idea to look for time-varying equivalence principle violation. And that is a way of doing direct detection of dark matter, perhaps. So the idea here is if dark matter, perhaps, there are models that suggest that dark matter could be weakly coupled light bosons. If that's the case, if it's going to explain dark matter, then you need a lot of these particles to make up the observed densities. So in that case, there's so many particles, it's best to think about as a field rather than as particles. There's a sort of a macroscopic occupancy of these dark matter candidates. And so you can think about kind of like a new electric field. So here's the Earth with this new dark matter field. If there is such a new field, it could be a scalar field, it could be a vector field. It will oscillate in time at a frequency given by the mass of the particle. So this is then the force you would expect to see between the two on a test mass would depend on the local density of the dark matter and oscillating at a characteristic frequency of that particle. So in particular, the couplings to matter would not necessarily or would almost certainly not be universal. So you would expect different types of material, different kinds of atoms would couple differently to this. And so you would see an oscillating equivalence principle violating force. So this is sort of an example of such a, this I think is once again B minus L coupled, in this case vector dark matter candidate, versus sort of the what possible mass of the particle and the strength or the coupling G, how strongly coupled it is. And you can see in red are, area already ruled out is in yellow, and then the red dashed lines show what our atom interferometer could do comparing rubidium-85 and rubidium-87. And so you can sort of start to take a bite out of some of this parameter space, potentially. To sort of wrap things up, the last part of the talk I wanted to tell you about gravitational waves and what we think we might be able to do with atoms. Obviously, it's an extremely exciting time to talk about gravitational wave astronomy. I don't think I need to motivate at all why it's a thing we want to do. With the recent detection at LIGO, the new window into the universe has been opened. We can stop saying promises to open. We can now say it is open. I'm very motivated by that. So why consider atoms? We've got a great detector in LIGO. And what I want to tell you about is how to use atom interferometry to look in frequency ranges that are complementary to LIGO and on both the Earth and in space. Why would you consider looking at that? Neutral atoms are great inertial test masses. They don't respond very well, or they respond very weakly to external fields. So that's a good plus. And we have atom interferometry, which is a great way of reading out, following the geodesics or measuring the geodesic motion of an atom. Perhaps not as obvious why I'll say this, but I'll get to it. Atoms are great clocks. As you probably know, the clock community has been pushing the clock precision by orders of magnitude per year. It seems like the current record atomic clock there's been a measured fractional frequency uncertainty of 10 to the minus 18. So that's a clock that loses a second in the lifetime of the universe. So the question is, can we use that technology, that precision, and atom interferometry? Can we combine these things in such a way to do some interesting physics, to look for gravitational waves? And I'll tell you how we think we can do that. Gravitational waves. You know the idea. In spiral, you know, 230 solar mass black holes a long way away are oscillating around, and we get waves here that we want to detect. So in principle, if you just had a couple of test masses shown here, these black dots, a couple of rocks sitting in space, following geodesics, the distance between those, or the proper distance between those, say, will oscillate with strain H and frequency omega. So one of the, I think, very interesting advantages to the atom interferometer approach, which I'll try to explain or try to convince you of, is the it is not required to use multiple baselines. So what I mean by that, so LIGO is obviously shaped like an L. Why is that? So in principle, what I just told you should be enough. Two test masses, measure the distance between them, that's a gravity wave. LIGO doesn't do that because you need a really good laser to do that. So the laser the LIGO has is not quiet enough to measure the distance between the two test mirrors on one arm at enough precision to see a gravitational wave. So the trick that they do is they send the same noisy laser, in some sense, down both arms of the interferometer simultaneously and take a differential measurement between those two. The laser noise cancels. And since a gravitational wave is quadrupolar, the signal is enhanced by a factor of 2. Factor 2 is not why you do it. It's nice. The reason you do it is because of the laser noise. It goes away. So in particular, if you want to do a space-based version of LIGO, and you need to do something that has this sort of, you need two arms that aren't parallel. They have to be perpendicular or at least at some angle. And so that's why LISA has to have three satellites, so that they have two, they can have at least two baselines to compare, to get rid of the laser noise. And so I want to explain to you how an atom interferometer version of LISA, for example, would only need two spacecraft. It would only need one baseline. It could implement this sort of ideal version of a gravitational wave detector, or sorry, not ideal, but simplest version of a gravitational wave detector, which is two test masses. And that possibly could be potentially a cost-saving thing if you have two spacecraft instead of three. OK, so the essential features of this, we're going to try to take advantage of the fact that atoms are really good clocks. So we're going to put an atom at each end of a long baseline. So the atom is playing the role of the test mass, like the mirrors of LIGO. And we want to measure oscillation, the distance between those two atoms. And so we're going to use light to measure that distance, just like they do in LIGO. And we're going to measure the time it takes light to cross the baseline using a clock on each end. And so that assumes, of course, that the propagation of light happens at a fixed speed. So that's an assumption. So we can't have any index of refraction in here moving around. But other than that, there aren't a lot of things that this requires other than really good clocks and light propagating across the baseline. OK, so how do we measure that with atoms? So I'm going to, once again, take a two-level atom, ground and excited state, with some energy difference omega A between them. I got an atomic clock on each end. So I start the clock by applying a laser pulse. That laser pulse starts on one end of the screen and travels across. When it hits the atom on the left, it puts that atom in a superposition of a ground excited state. Then that pulse continues to travel across the baseline, and it starts the time on the second clock by putting it in a superposition of ground excited. So after that pulse, time goes flows down here. I'll start the clocks. As time evolves, they pick up phase, which is just given by the energy difference between those two atomic states, omega A, times the duration T that we let the clock tick. And as you can see, they both pick up the same phase as I've drawn it. So to stop the clocks, we apply a second laser pulse. Pulse comes in, it stops the clock on the left. It travels across and stops the second clock. I've described a Ramsey sequence as how many atomic clocks work with just a two-pulse sequence. So far, nothing interesting. However, if a gravitational wave were to go by in time, right in the middle of this sequence, so gravity wave comes by right here, stretches space-time a little bit. Now, as compared to the first pulse, the second pulse is going to take a little bit longer to cross the baseline than it otherwise would have, because space has grown, let's say, by the gravitational wave. And so what that means is that it takes extra time delta t to cross. And so the clock on the right will have picked up more phase. By delta t is proportional to the strain h and the baseline l. That's the whole effect. Look for that extra phase on this clock compared to that one. So there's a signal. But what about noise? Noise from the laser is the thing we're trying to circumvent here. That's the thing why LIGO and LISA need multiple arms. Now, the important point is that the phase of the laser is definitely important for the atom case. That phase gets written directly onto the atom's wave function, a point that I haven't stressed too much, but it's definitely true. And so here's that effect. When the laser pulse, if you assume the laser pulse has some phase phi sub L, the wave function I really should have written should have e to the I phi L imprinted on it. But the point is that whatever that phase is, no matter how noisy it is, it's going to get written on the atom on the left. And that pulse is going to travel across the baseline. It's not affected as it propagates. And that same phase will get written on the atom on the right. So when you compare these two clocks, the phase difference that you're interested in, will that noise will cancel. That phase the laser drops out. That's the assertion. As a result, a differential measurement is insensitive to laser frequency and phase noise. Now, it turns out that this simple sequence I showed you with two laser pulses is not a great way to make a gravitational wave detector. In fact, what you want to do is at least a three-pulse sequence, very similar to the ones that I showed you initially, an accelerometer sequence, pi over 2, pi, pi over 2. It turns out simply because this interferometer that I just described, the clock interferometer, would be sensitive to linear Doppler shift. So we can cancel that if we make an accelerometer. But the fundamental idea that we're measuring the light travel time and that the phase noise cancels, that's absolutely still true. Okay, so here's what it would look like. You would imagine having a source of atoms on two sides of a baseline. You send a common laser beam back and forth between the two satellites and implement atom interferometry, sort of artist rendition right here. No, laser back and forth. So the atom is on one. So this is a simplified version. I'll give you a more detailed version. The atom lives over here inside one satellite. The other atom lives over here inside the other satellite. We're only sending lasers back and forth, just like you would in LISA. So it's sort of a cartoon here, right? Where you have an atom cloud and another atom cloud, and they're separated by a very long distance. You can't send the atom across the whole baseline, right? Take forever. I mentioned that the two-pole sequence isn't the way to do it. This is the details of how to build an accelerometer sequence, a three-pulse accelerometer sequence that implements this laser phase noise cancellation that we need. I won't go into all the details, but this is a space-time diagram showing that. Atom. This is one atom on the right, the other atom on the left, so you take a phase difference between those two. I just put this to show that we can use the same techniques to send light back and forth multiple times to do the large momentum transfer results, like the 90 h bar k data I showed you. We can get the same kind of phase enhancement in the gravitational wave detector, essentially because every time we send light back and forth, we measure that time again and again, and we can build up that knowledge and get an enhanced sensitivity in that way. So we can get the same phase enhancement that we're getting from the large momentum transfer techniques. Turns out we need to use a different kind of atom than rubidium for this. Strontium is a great candidate, and that's work that I'm working on right now, is demonstrating that this technique of canceling the laser noise between two atoms can work at the level that we would think it needs for gravitational wave detection. This is just an example of one configuration. There's lots of parameters you can vary here. But red here shows the sort of projected strain sensitivity of an atom-based detector. So h per root hertz, the strain sensitivity on the vertical axis versus frequency. As you can see, advanced LIGO over here at the high frequency range. And LISA here is shown in blue. And so these parameters were picked to sort of be similar to science, a similar science reach as LISA. But one thing I want to emphasize is that the baseline that we assumed for this red curve is 1,000 kilometers, which is over 1,000 times smaller than the LISA baseline. And so the reason that we can get sort of somewhat comparable sensitivity, even though the baseline is a fraction of the LISA baseline, is we can enhance the sensitivity by using these large momentum transfer techniques that I was telling you about. That's a linear increase in our sensitivity. So we can sort of trade off baseline for atom optics in some sense. It's a handle we can use to sort of change the geometry, which might be interesting for optimizing the design. Yeah, so thanks. I wasn't going to mention that, but there's a gray curve on here, which we call resonant detection. This is just an example of the kind of flexibility we think you can have with this kind of detector. The idea is that instead of making a single diamond, these loops all kind of look like diamonds, these atom interferometers. They kind of look like one loop. Instead of doing one loop, there's nothing stopping you, in principle, from sending the atoms back and forth multiple times before you finish the interferometer, making a multiple loop diamond.
So basically, at the last
You let them. You don't apply the last pi over two pulse. They fly right through each other.
Yep. They just apply another
pi pulse after that to reverse them. Pi, 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 pi. And so what the atoms are doing is they're going back and forth at a frequency of your choosing.
And you're saying that you can do it 40 times, 100 h/k.
That's the idea. So the idea is that you can enhance the sensitivity. You're basically as long as you're bringing the atoms back and forth at the same frequency and in phase with a signal of interest, you're coherently adding up the response of that signal. you pay a penalty in the baseline. So the baseline is very narrow because you're only looking at frequencies that line up with what you're doing. But it's sort of a narrow band detector now, and I would argue you can move that around. So it's kind of you can put it at different locations depending on what you're interested in. And I should emphasize that's a software change. The hardware wouldn't need to change. You could have this broadband mode. If you found a signal you liked, you could then zoom in and oscillate a little bit around there and sort of get enhanced information about that. And then you could go back to a broadband mode. Okay. So in fact, we're working on thinking about these resonant in a lot more detail right now. That's ongoing theory work. But we think that's pretty interesting. So you can do stochastic gravitational wave detection in the millihertz band, or probably a little bit higher is even more interesting. I just put this in to mention it's something we're interested, or to say it's something that we're interested in looking at. This plot shows so stochastic gravitational waves that could come from these are primordial gravitational waves, let's say from inflation or from phase transitions in the early universe, basically signals of cosmological interest. They would produce kind of a white background noise of gravitational waves. So can you see that? This shows the strength, in some sense, the amount of energy in such gravitational waves versus frequency. And you can see the red curve coming in here for our apparatus. These orange lines show the expected or projected power levels for cosmic string networks that could be shaking around producing gravitational waves. And then the sort of maybe the holy grail would be to find an inflation signal. We think probably this red line is not the way you'd do it. You'd probably want to come in closer to a hertz, where this gray band, which is binary white noise confusion, you could get a little bit above that. And so we're working on thinking about ways to try to apply the resonant mode in particular to try to look for perhaps getting down to the inflation signal with an atom interferometer. That's still ongoing work, so I can't say too much more about that. Just to wrap things up, someone asked earlier a little bit more about details. This is a more detailed version. And boy, the gray is totally lost. There's supposed to be gray boxes around these. Sorry. So this is one satellite. This is a second satellite. And this is just showing you a little bit more detail what it would look like. You have your atoms inside the satellite. This is actually a slight modification of the technique where we have a way to actually do Lisa-like baselines if we want. We can use really long baselines. And that uses the same trick that uses the same kind of laser link, very similar to at least the laser links that Lisa uses. Essentially, it lets you get around the problem that if the baseline's really long, the lasers that you send across get really weak by the time they're received at the other satellite. And what you can do is you can use heterodyne beat note over here on a photodetector with a local oscillator laser, and you can essentially lock a local laser that's very strong to the incoming weak laser, and you can use that strong laser to interrogate the atoms. So you're no longer limited by baseline, some of our earlier designs were. We can do sort of Lisa-like baselines and still maintain the kind of laser noise immunity that that I was telling you about. And so this is what the sensitivity you can get with those kind of baselines. This is, I think, my last slide. So here's Lisa again in gray. If you can use a bigger baseline, then you can trade off and use a smaller amount of large momentum transfer. So the green curve shows a 2H bar K interferometer, which is the very first data I showed you. And it's sort of coming in at a somewhat similar level to Lisa, even with very, very simple atom optics. If you go to a little bit of enhancement there, a 12H bar K interferometer shown here in blue, you can do something like 10 times better than Lisa over a range of interesting frequencies. And so being able to extend the baseline is another interesting tool that we're considering for different designs. Anyways, with that, I really appreciate your time. And I want to thank my collaborators at Stanford, experimental collaborators, but also theory collaborators, and former group members. So, and I'll take some questions if you guys still have.
Questions? Yes?
Yeah, so could you imagine modifying this thing to maybe look at something like geodetic precession? If you had spinning atoms, as this thing orbits the Earth, the atoms will follow, they'll precess.
Yeah.
Is there any hope?
There's been some thought about that. Yeah, I can't say too much about it, but we did look into whether you could see the lens flaring effect, for example, yeah, using two atom gyroscopes. It's hard. It's really hard. I guess it didn't look impossible, though. So I guess you don't necessarily need to use spinning atoms. You can actually implement gyroscopes by making atoms around it. That's why all the interferometers I showed you were space-time interferometers. They're vertical. But if you open up an area, then you're sensitive to rotation, and you can use you can essentially make a very good gyroscope and do something sort of like what GPB did in that sense by looking for these small rotation forces. But I can't say much more than that. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so I should have said that. All of the sensitivity curves that I showed here are, you could say, the standard quantum limit. So these are, but in this case, they're limited by the atom shot noise. So the phase resolution of these interferometers can be limited by just how many atoms you count in the two ports. So the more atoms, the smaller that is, like root n. And so those are all sort of atom shot noise floors there that we're putting in. Right. So the sort of the radiation pressure is, I mean, if you want to, you can think about the radiation pressure as this momentum kick that we're giving to the atom, and it's sort of regularized in some sense by the way that we absorb and then emit the photons. So there's not a noise associated with that. We do with the long baselines, like this plot here that I showed. These are baselines sort of at sort of 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 9 meters. There, you are limited ultimately by photon shot noise, just like Lisa is. Like the ability to pick up the lock here, to lock the two lasers together, will be limited by how many photons you collect from the other laser. And so that's built into these sensitivity curves. And it's the same numbers that Lisa gets. You need to collect a certain number of photons. If your baseline's too big, you don't get enough, and you can't reliably ensure that the phase noise cancels. So in that sense, in the long baseline case, we're limited by atom shot noise and by photon shot noise of the incoming reference laser.
Any more questions?
So what is the status of this? Is this happening?
Yeah, so I should, absolutely. So right now there's a couple of questions about to get the laser noise cancellation that we need to work, we need to use strontium atoms. And that's because strontium supports, it has an excellent two-level system that you can, there's a single photon transition that exists with a long excited state lifetime. And interferometry hasn't been done with that kind of atom before in this way, that's inertially sensitive in this way. So that's being built right now. We're to test that. So the sort of we can answer some of these fundamental questions in the next year or two. In the meantime, prototypes are being developed in a couple of places. We're working on trying to get something happening at Stanford. In France, there's a project called MIGA, where they have actually some tunnel space allocated. They've already dug holes, and they're building some atom interferometer tubes initially to do geophysics and measure vibration noise essentially in the surrounding soil. And water table fluctuations, things like that. And the hope is that by characterizing that, they'll learn about gravity gradient noise, which is a limit that you can't get around with the atom interferometer, and be able to go at lower frequencies on the Earth. I didn't mention this, but one of the advantages for a terrestrial detector for atom interferometry is the pendulums that LIGO uses are to decouple from the vibration noise, the test masses. The atom is in free fall during the experiment, so the direct coupling to the shaking is really well suppressed. So that's a huge advantage. But even if you can get rid of that, you can't get rid of the gravity coupling, right? The fact that the shaking dirt is gravitationally coupling to your atoms, and that causes a noise called Newtonian noise or gravity gradient noise. It happens at a little bit lower frequencies, but it still will ultimately limit any terrestrial detector. But there's thought that it can be characterized potentially with an array of interferometers and that can measure the spatial variation of it and potentially take it out. And so that's work that's going on right now, as I said, in France. So I think there is some early development work on for these things. In fact, one of our sponsors has been NASA for a number of years. We've been working with NASA Goddard in pushing this technology for gravitational wave detection. So there are people that are, I think, interested in that, in the space-based stuff as well. Probably initially to do geodesy. So the idea would be to put a smaller baseline version of this detector in space and use it to do what GRACE has done, to measure the mass distribution of the Earth, and potentially at a higher sensitivity, and with the hope of seeing sort of centimeter variations in water table height, for example, is what you think you could be able to do with this kind of sensor. So there's hope that kind of push will translate into gravitational wave detection later on.
Jason again.